session number 1, 2, 3, 7, 1, reel 3.
Yes, no, I'm quite right. It was Epernay. The Pivot was between Epernay and Chalon-sur-Marne. When all the airmen arrived and they were, as I say, sleeping in these barns on straw, of course we had to give them very strict instructions not to smoke. I was made officer in charge of distributing the blankets. They were all given 2 blankets each, which came in on a lorry of some sort. And so I went round with the French interpreter because I had to deal with the various farmers who owned the barns in which the airmen were accommodated. And although I had drunk my ration of drink in my young life, I suddenly found myself insistently being invited by these farmers back to their farmhouses to have a drink with them. And this was usually a bottle of cherry brandy that was taken from some hiding place under the floorboards. And it was an absolute killer. And I remember one evening arriving back in my billet and being violently sick, having had an evening of drinking this very, very ripe cherry brandy. My own billet was in a house in the main street, and I had quite a nice room on the first floor, quite a large room, very sparsely furnished, of course, didn't have any carpets on the floor or anything like that. But in order to get to it, I had to come straight through the front door, which went straight into the kitchen, which was the main room in the house, and then up the stairs, which went up from the kitchen to my room. Very often the smells in the kitchen were absolutely ghastly. I don't think they ever opened the windows or anything. And moreover, it was invariably full of flies. And so I used to take a deep breath outside the door, rush through the door and hope to be able to get up the stairs before Madame stopped me and tried to engage me in conversation, in which case I'd suddenly have to release my breath and take a very deep breath full of smells and flies. It was one of the less pleasant parts of my accommodation, but the room itself was comfortable and I certainly had no complaints. We all of us learnt, of course, the French habit of using one plate and the same knife and fork throughout your meal. That's all we had, and it was something that was very new to most of us. So far as operations were concerned, we were, of course, now that the the full squadron arrived, we were carrying out practice flying. Now, I should point out at this stage that we, when we were in the UK, we were due to be part of that element of the BEF called Air Component. Air Component was the RAF element that controlled the Army Corporation squadrons and the fighters. The other part of the RAF element in France was the Advanced Air Striking Force, which was comprised the Battles and the Blenheims, in other words, the medium and light bomber element of the force. On the outbreak of war, 57 numbers 57 and 18 squadrons were supposed to be the two Blenheim squadrons that were to comprise the medium bomber element, but neither of them was ready to proceed. I don't know why. And so 53 squadron were diverted from the air component to the advanced air striking force, and this is why we were at Plevo, because we should really have gone to an airfield further north. As I say, we carried out practice flying, and in the evenings we often used to find our way into Epernay, which of course was the centre of the champagne industry. And above Epernay was a little restaurant up on the hill, which is now a very expensive establishment, but in those days was just an ordinary, quite nice bar restaurant. And we used to go up there, and there we met up with a number of the French army. One of the more pleasant things about this was they usually had some girlfriends with them. They were all regular army, and the girls were all obviously from the upper strata of French society, but at least it gave us somebody to dance with. And I always remember that it was there that we first heard that song that became so famous, J'attendrai, which of course had not reached England by that time. And I remember we tried to buy the record from the café proprietor, but he wouldn't sell it to us. But I think the thing that was interesting about this particular association, I remember talking to one of the army officers, French army officers, who spoke excellent English, who was in a cavalry regiment. And I said to him, how do you see things? And he said, well, he said, I have no doubts about the French regular army. He said, but I'm very doubtful about the reserves. Well, now, of course, he was talking about really what was the bulk of the French army, i.e. the conscripts. And, of course, at that time, most of the regular French army were, of course, in the Lee Maginot, or the Maginot Line, as we know it. And it was interesting, this conversation, because, in fact, it subsequently, very tragically, turned out to be true. Well, eventually, our first operation came along. I remember some staff officers coming down from Advanced Air Striking Force, and they disappeared into the squadron commander's office tent. And then they went on their way, and the squadron commander gathered us all together and said, we've been given some operations to carry out, which was rather exciting. None of us had ever been to war before, and I think it forced the adrenaline to run a little bit. Our task was to fly up to Hanover and back at night to see if we could see any signs of the Germans moving troops up to the Western Front.
When would this have been, approximately?
In September. It was either September or early October 1939. I'd have to look at my logbook. We couldn't operate at night out of Plevo because, firstly, it was too small, and secondly, it had no night flying facilities. And so we were required to fly forward to Metz during the day and we then were to take off from Metz at night. However, we weren't going to land back at Metz. We were going to land back at another airfield that wasn't all that far from Plevo, called Vitry. This was a French airfield where they had night flying facilities. Moreover, they had a WTDR station there as well. And of course, we were operating on WT. All our communication was by WT. Well, now, one must remember that, as in England, the whole of France and Germany was completely blacked out. There were no lights on the ground at all. And this made night flying a very different matter to the night flying one had been used to, when you've got all the cities and towns and streets and things lit up. One was flying over a completely black area. At a certain height in the distance, you could see the lights of Belgium. But by and large, one was flying in a completely black atmosphere. Now, it is perhaps interesting to note at this stage that I have more night flying on the Blenheim than anybody else in the squadron, and I had 10 hours. My flight commander, this Canadian, had 4 hours, and he was going on the first sortie. We were to go in threes, not to operate as a formation, but three separate sorties. And as I say, the three aircraft would fly forward to Metz. They brief, and then when night came, they took off individually and flew their courses up to Hanover and back. We normally used parachute flares at night to help us see what was going on the ground. And the ordinary flares we used in peacetime were training flares. They were made of a comparatively light material and did not have the same length of burning time that the operational flares had that we were eventually given on the outbreak of war. However, we were told that we were not to drop parachute flares, the reason being that the operational parachute flares, which burnt for considerably longer than the training flares and gave a much better illumination, were contained in a fairly heavy container, and they were afraid that one of these containers might go through the roof of somebody's house and cause damage and therefore spark off hostilities that nobody at that moment seemed to want to spark off. I know this all sounds ridiculous at this stage, but this is exactly what happened. So we were taking off from Metz. We were flying at 20,000 feet over Germany on a pitch black night with no lights on the ground, and we were expected to be able to see whether the Germans were moving their forces up to the Western Front. The French had developed a system over certainly the northern part of France, which in concept sounded quite good. What they'd done was they put hundreds of little flashing beacons all over the countryside, and the principle was that you drew a line on your map from A to B, and you then got what was known as the Fiche de la Balisage, which was a big map showing where all these little flashing lights were and the identification letter that they were flashing. And the idea was that having drawn your line on the map, you then put along that line the little flashing lights with the identification letters they were flashing, and also the little flashing lights so many degrees to either side. And the idea was, of course, that the navigator sat in the nose of the aircraft with his map, and he saw A come up, and then B, and then C, or whatever it was, and realised he was on course. And if X came up, he knew he was 1 degree off to starboard, or port as the case may be, and he could give the pilot an adjustment. And so the principle of the thing was quite good. The only thing was that you couldn't see it above 1,500 feet, which meant, of course, you couldn't see it at all. The French had told us that if we got into serious trouble, particularly on our return journey, that they would be prepared to accept a homing call, and they would give us a homing back to Vitry. Well, the first three aircraft went off. As I say, my flight commander was one of them. Another chap, Jazz Reed, who was in B flight, was another, and I can't remember who the third one was. They took off from Metz, and as I say, they saw nothing. On the way to Hanover, Jazz Reed's air gunner came back down the aircraft and said he thought they were being followed by a German aircraft. He'd never seen a German aircraft in his life, of course. And so Jazz said to him, well, if it comes anywhere near, shoot at it, you see. Well, these K-guns that we had in the back, of course, had no safety guard on them that were fitted to later aircraft. In other words, if you swung the gun round with it firing, you could quite easily shoot your own tailplane off. And in fact, this is exactly what happened. This chap opened fire on a Shadow, which I don't think was an aircraft at all, and all he did was to knock the top of their tailplane off. Neither aircraft or neither pilot saw anything. I'm not sure that either of them ever knew whether they reached Hanover or not. Because, as I say, although Bill Clements had the best navigator in the squadron, Jasper Reed's navigator was one of these inexperienced chaps. And so whether, in fact, they ever actually reached Hanover or not, I don't think anybody would ever know. But they set off for home. And Bill Clements kept asking Cronin whether he knew where they were, and Cronin, being a typical navigator, kept saying, yes, he did. But Bill suddenly realised he was beginning to get short of fuel, and they still didn't seem to be identifying anything. And eventually Cronin had to admit that he hadn't the remotest idea where they were. So Bill then asked his WT, his WAP AG, to call for an emergency homing from Vitry, which he did. The French thought it might be a German aircraft trying to home in on Vitry and so didn't reply. And this happened to Jasper Reed as well. So there was Clements on this pitch dark night, completely lost and beginning to get short of fuel. Eventually he decided to reduce height until he to a level at which he could see the ground, which he did, and he got down to about 300 feet when both his engines stopped. He said he didn't know why he did it, but he put his undercarriage down And he put down his flaps and he turned on his landing lamp. And of course, for anybody who is familiar with France, particularly the north of France, is covered with these enormous fields. And by the grace of God, Bill happened to be over one of these fields. There wasn't a wood in the way, and he put the aeroplane down in this field on a pitch black night, completely undamaged. And they came to a halt. They all got out of the aircraft. Bill reached down into the depths of his Sidcot suit and produced a large flask of whiskey that he had with him, and they all had a drink. Jasper Reed, getting no reply from Vitry either, eventually came across a completely lit airfield, which in fact was a French fighter airfield where they were doing some night flying. So Jazz landed, and he in fact had more fuel left than Bill Clemens, and he asked the Frenchman in his pigeon South African, because he was in fact a South African, if he was anywhere near Vitry, and they said, oh yes, it was only 20 miles down the road. So he took off again, and he got to Vitry, and they turned the lights on, and he landed. And these were the days in the Blenheim where the undercarriage and flap levers were right next door to one another and were exactly the same shape. The undercarriage lever was in the front and the flap lever was at the back. And after one had landed, because of the attitude of the aircraft and the nose of the aircraft, there was a tendency for the pilot to lean forward a bit to see where he was going, with the result that his hand would automatically fall on the undercarriage lever instead of the flap lever. And so Jazz, having eventually arrived back safely, pulled up the undercarriage on the ground. I might say that soon after that, the shape of the undercarriage lever was changed to prevent this sort of thing happening. Well, the only sortie that I went on, and I can't remember whether it was the second or the third set of sorties, the leader was the flight commander of B Flight, Eric Joyce, the chap who spoke French, and myself and another chap from our flight called Peter Bone, who was killed later on in France. We flew forward to Metz in our three Blenheims. Now, Metz is not all that far behind the German lines, but we lined our Blenheims up wingtip to wingtip, as we'd always done in peacetime. It was a nice sunny day. We did our briefing, and then we took our jackets off and we all lay down on the grass in the sun and enjoyed the sunshine. Meanwhile, six French Curtiss Hawks, which they'd just taken delivery of from the United States, took off and climbed up and proceeded to do sort of fancy formation flying at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet above the airfield, backwards and forwards across the airfield. It was clear, I imagine, from what subsequently happened, that they too didn't have any sort of radio telephonic communication, or if they did, it obviously wasn't very good. Because shortly afterwards, an old Dewatine biplane, which was probably rather the size of a swordfish, open cockpit, chap in the back and pilot in the front, taxied out, and it took off and proceeded to carry out circuits and landings. So there was a scene. It was a nice sunny day with one or two puffy clouds. Six Curtis Hawks going backwards and forwards over the airfield, changing formation. Dewatine doing circuits and landings, making a nice buzzy sort of noise. And we were lying in the sun, rather enjoying what we were seeing, when all of a sudden, onto the circuit came a 109, flying at about 50 feet. Well, of course, none of us had ever seen a 109 in our lives before. It came on the circuit at very high speed and proceeded to chase this Dewatine round the airfield. Well, the Dewatine obviously didn't realise the fellow was there to start with until he opened fire. And then he started to do some sort of evasive manoeuvres. Clearly he wasn't any more experienced in air combat than we were. Meanwhile, the six Curtis Hawks were busy going backwards and forwards across the airfield, changing formation. And, of course, eventually, the 109 hit this Dewatine, and there was a great puff of smoke and flame, and the thing fell in a great ball of flame in the middle of the airfield, and the 109 was gone. The whole thing seemed to take about 10 minutes, but obviously took probably less than a minute. And I think this scene had a very dramatic effect on us, because it suddenly, in those few seconds, brought home to us what war was about.
Which airfield was this?
Metz. That
and which month do you think that might have been?
Well, I'd have to check. I think it's in October.
In the autumn.
I'm sure it was in October, in fact. Maybe in the beginning of November, it was October, November. That evening, we took off on our sortie. And in fact, it was quite uneventful. We didn't see anything. And all three of us arrived back at Vitry. On this occasion, the French homing station at Vitry gave us some assistance, so we all got back in one piece and the whole flight was quite uneventful.
Where had you gone to on that?
Hanover. Metz to Hanover. Well, I've forgotten how many more sorties were done by night before it occurred to advanced air striking force that they won't get any results. So they appeared again, and they all disappeared into the squadron commander's office tent, and when they'd gone, he came out and said, "They want us to do it in daylight." So we thought, yes, that was quite a good idea, because now we'd be able to take photographs. I can't remember how many sorties were flown. It was probably one or two, or three possibly, before somebody said, "Surely, if we keep flying from..."